This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Brandon Contes.
All righty. Welcome to episode 5 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Contes, and this week we have Lee Diffie joining us. Lee, who works for NBC and has called just about every sport there is on wheels, and he's also their lead play-by-play announcer for IndyCar, which is a sport that I am admittedly not an expert on, but with the Indy 500 this weekend, we want to get somebody on who can help offer some perspective as to just how big of a sporting event this is. So, Lee, thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. I would imagine this is one of the busier weeks for you ahead of the Indianapolis 500.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. Thanks for having me on. It's one of the busier weeks, but it's also one of the most exciting weeks.
Sure.
Just the way that it all funnels down leading up to Sunday, Memorial Day weekend. So couldn't be more excited.
I want to start a little bit with the beginning of your sports casting career, because I think it's a pretty interesting story that deserves some spotlighting. You grow up in Australia. What was your background in motorsports growing up? Was it just as a fan? Did you have aspirations of broadcasting professionally? Did you maybe even have aspirations of racing professionally?
Never had any aspirations to race professionally. My skill set told me that that was never going to be an option. And never grew up dreaming of being a broadcaster either, to be frank. I grew up in a motorsport family. My father bought us kids motorcycles when we were very young. I started racing motorbikes, dirt track motorbikes, when I was 6 years old, and raced for till I was about 16 or 17. And then I stopped and just hung around the scene. You know, my older brother and lots of other friends still kept racing, and I focused on my studies but I still kind of hung around that group, and I would go to the races. And then it literally happened, you know, you hear those stories, I fell into it. It was the local motorcycle club that I used to race at. They were in need of a commentator. I'd made a few speeches over the years as a young guy, you know, for my brother if he wasn't there. And they said, oh, you seem pretty confident on a microphone. Would you like to take a crack at this commentary thing? And just for the public address, you know, just for the fans
right.
And the stands. And that's where it all started.
So at the time, you were a physical education teacher as your career as a sportscaster was getting started. So even when you did start those to get those opportunities, were you treating it as a hobby at that point? Were you still thinking that you had a career in teaching, or was that just to help pay the bills?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I started, I was still in college. Actually, I was only 20 years old when that invitation came, and then, you know, it was like a month or two later, there was another dirt bike club, another motorcycle club, you know, actually from Toowoomba, where Will Power, the reigning series champion and also Indy 500 winner, where Will's from, there was a club in Toowoomba that said, hey, we heard you, you know, several weeks ago, we'd like you to come and commentate for us. And you know, maybe in that first year, I may have done a handful of commentary jobs. And
sure.
And then the next year, I might have done, you know, a few more and traveled further and traveled interstate. And it kind of it grew year on year. And it was only when I was school teaching and getting jobs like Supercross, you know, so like we have here in the States, Monster Energy Supercross. In Australia at the time, it was called Supercross Masters. And I would find myself in these big arenas, Sydney Entertainment Centre, the National Tennis Centre in Melbourne, Rod Laver Arena, I'd be in Adelaide or whatever, and I'd be trying to get the first flight out on a Monday morning to make it back to school assembly and start teaching school. And I knew then that it was growing at such a rate that maybe I might have a chance. I don't know. I took a leap of faith. And I stopped school teaching at the end of 1995 and beginning of 96. So I really tried to focus on that and thought, well, and my parents encouraged me. They had no background in media whatsoever. Blue collar mum and dad, you know, just regular working folks. And they had no idea how to encourage me or whatever other than just to have a go. You know, like if you really feel you can do this, we'll support you the best we can. And I ended up moving from Brisbane to Sydney and was persistent and a lot of hard work, but also some luck as well, some fortune, right time, right place, knew some people, tried hard, worked hard, and got given that opportunity.
Did you ever feel that there was any sort of animosity towards you from other people in the industry as you were starting to find job opportunities without taking the more traditional route to being a sportscaster or even being a more classically trained broadcaster like some of the other people in the industry might be?
Great question, Brandon, and 100%. And I got it in my face. In the newsroom, you know, because I didn't go to university and study journalism or communications. You know, I was a physical education teacher and came in through the back door, so to speak, through my commentary. And when the network that I started working for showed a lot of interest in me, they said, well, we know that you can commentate. We know that you can call a race, but you're going to have to learn the business of television. So we want to give you a job, like just a freelance job as a reporter on a show then called Sports Tonight, and which would be the equivalent of like ESPN Sports Center here. And I was a freelance reporter, and I was sitting in one of Australia's largest newsrooms. I couldn't even type. I didn't know how to type, so I'd hide off in the corner and, you know, single finger type on the keyboard. I knew the voiceover part, and I knew that me talking or speaking or doing voiceovers, you know, I wasn't worried about that, but it was learning the business of television and learning the different elements. And so, yeah, I got some resistance, and they didn't hold back in coming forward and letting me know that, you know, you don't really belong here. You shouldn't be here. You know, you didn't go to school to study for this. If it wasn't for motorsport, you have no place being at this network. I had people tell me that to my face, like other journalists, other reporters. And, but you just have to, you know, you have to very quickly grow a thick skin and move on.
What year did you get your first paying sportscasting job in Australia?
So as far as on television?
Yeah.
1996.
And then what year did you end up moving to the United States? That was 2003?
2002, but 2002? In between, I went to the United Kingdom. I went to London. So I was only in Australia on television in Australia for not quite 3.5 years.
Okay.
And had some opportunities to go to England and Europe with Formula One launches. And then on two occasions in 1998 and 1999, I went to the 24 Hours of Le Mans. And just in those 2 years in particular, doing several trips to both Europe and to the UK really got my appetite, you know, hungry for what this bigger life, this bigger pond was. And I had a terrific job. I had a job that I perhaps could have kept forever in Australia, and was working on V8 supercars and IndyCar and Formula One and MotoGP. And, you know, I was young. I was only in my 20s, and right. and I loved it. I got some wonderful opportunities and capitalized on those very young. But then I got hungry, and I had some people encourage me that I could do it. I was young enough, and I could do it. I could make it. And in fact, the gentleman who I stood in the pit lane with at Le Mans in 1999, an older gentleman from Australia, a journalist, and ran a creative agency for many years. His name is John Smales. John is coming to be with me this weekend in Indianapolis.
Oh, wow.
To watch his first Indy 500.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Was it a bigger transition going from like just a more from a life standpoint, going from Australia to the UK, or moving from the UK to the United States?
Definitely the UK to the United States, because transitioning from Australia to the UK, you know, we're part of the Commonwealth, right. You know, Aussies and Brits love to give each other grief. Brits call us a bunch of convicts and criminals, and, you know, we come from a penal colony, and, but there's a love-hate relationship there, because ostensibly it's the motherland, right? So that was not such a stark contrast, but
yeah.
Moving from London, moving from the west side of London to Atlanta, Georgia, in 2002, that was a stark contrast. That was an eye opener.
How was that adjustment? That culture shock? Because obviously, relocating for a job can always be challenging, but there definitely has to be an added sense of culture shock when you're from Australia and now you're in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah, and just dealing with, you know, not only everyday things like just cultural differences, food differences,
yeah.
You know, the just terminology, phraseology, you know, instead of saying, you know, hey, I'll post you that letter, you have to say, I'll mail you that letter. You know, just little nuances in the language that took a while to get used to. Getting a social security number before mm-hmm. you had it, before you had any credit history, you know, like, and just doing all those kinds of everyday things, but critical things to your everyday existence. You know, it's like it's starting from scratch. There was no history of Lee Diffie living in America. So you have to start from ground zero and got to be really patient, actually.
And when and why did you decide to become a US citizen?
Because growing up in Australia, a lot of my mates, their parents were from other countries, whether it be Papua New Guinea or Germany or Scotland or England or wherever it might have been. And I witnessed a lot of my friends' parents complaining about Australia or complaining about the taxes or complaining about the political system, but they never actually became an Australian citizen. And even as a youngster, I found that quite odd that they felt comfortable to complain about the system, but never actually became an Australian citizen, which right. would then afford them the right to vote. So they could contribute to making a change if they wanted to. And America has changed my life so much and enriched my life so much and given me so much in my career that why wouldn't I, when I have a choice, like I wasn't born here, but I had a choice to become an American. So for the country that's given me so much, why wouldn't I give back and show the same commitment that this country's given me?
Sure. So you moved to the United States to work with Speed. Then you join NBC in, was that 2013?
Yep.
And then the next year you're calling Olympic events. Uh-huh. So how did you go from motorsports to the Olympics?
In short, because my boss told me to. my boss Sam Flood said, "Look, I know you've done other sports, but primarily you call racing. Well, racing's not restricted to motorsport, right? Racing can be track and field. It could be rowing. It could be bobsled, skeleton, and luge. They're all races." They're just of a different kind. And he said, so we're going to throw some different things at you and see what sticks.
So after that pitch was made to you, do you now that you've called those different races, do you feel that is legitimate, that it is very similar?
For sure. And doing other disciplines of racing has made me better at motorsport, and doing motorsport has made me better at doing those other disciplines. And I do probably the most common crossover is between my motorsport work and my track and field, my athletics work. And, you know, in motorsport, I call races of all different durations. And in track and field, I get to call races of different durations. And there's been a lot of, you know, say, for instance, my endurance sports car racing, those longer races and longer form storytelling has made me better at calling distance track meets or track sure. events, and calling those distance track events has made me better at, you know, it's kind of this nice crossover. It's a strange existence, Brandon, I admit, but there's more crossover than what you'd think.
How is the preparation for these events that you're calling every couple of years? Because even if you assume racing is racing, whether it's on two wheels, four wheels, a bobsled or foot, you're still covering different athletes at the Olympics that you're not used to covering on a regular basis. So is it a lot of studying? Is it a lot of reliance on your producers and researchers?
All of the above. Yeah, there is. It's a lot. I have two sons and they're always asking me, Dad, come on, come outside. Why are you in the office again? You know, and I tell them that I'm probably doing more reading and writing now than I did when I was at university. So switching between different sports requires a lot of homework. We're very fortunate in whatever the sport that I'm working on, NBC provides us with research people. And that doesn't mean that it makes the job easier. In many ways, it just adds to what you have to do. So if you've got to read through this much, you might only use this much, and then you have to disseminate and decide how you're going to and where you're going to use that information. But you've got to read it all to have those stories kind of in your mind or at your fingertips, and then decide which part of that story is the most appropriate to use when and where. And that could be on anything from from, you know, motor racing to the Olympics, what will rugby, you know, we've got Rugby World Cup this year, whatever it might be, you got to do a lot for a little. But sometimes, well, not sometimes, all of the time, by doing your research, you're equipped and ready to enhance that storytelling the best way you can.
You took over as the lead play-by-play broadcaster for track and field at the Olympics. And in Tokyo for the 2020 Olympics, obviously those were played in 2021 because of the pandemic, but still had no fans. Did you call those in the U.S. or did you call those games in Tokyo?
No, we called them in Tokyo.
Oh, you were there.
And being in a 70,000 seat stadium with not many people in there was a weird feeling.
Sure. Yeah, I would imagine. And how were the protocols very strict when you were there? Was there some freedom once you got to Tokyo and endured the 2 weeks of quarantine?
There was no freedom, really, in terms of being able to go out and about. It was very well organized, but also very well executed and very well policed. And I have to say, for the most part, most people respected that.
Yeah,
we were fortunate on the track and field side of things that our hotel was pretty much next to the venue. So we would dine in our hotel. You know, obviously you sleep and do your research and dine in the hotel. And then we had a very short walk, probably 100 yards from the front door of our hotel was the screening facility for track and field. And then you'd go through the screening and another 100, 200 yards on was our TV compound. And inside there, we had our own food and catering and editing offices and production offices, et cetera. And then you would walk across the street to the venue. And that was our path. That was our track. That was our routine for those 2 weeks of quarantine. And we were coincided pretty nicely that our last night in Tokyo was our first night of freedom. And so there was a group of us that had, you know, a track and field group of us that had a small dinner together. And then we came back to the States the next day. So it was pretty, a lot of us felt very sorry for Japan and for Tokyo to host those games under those circumstances. But it's one that we'll never forget.
What about Beijing? Were you on site for the Winter Olympics last year?
That was the first time I've never been on site for the Olympics. And I had a good experience in doing remote broadcasting because that's how we used to do Formula One. We would go to a select few Formula One Grand Prix, Monaco, the US Grand Prix, the Canadian Grand Prix. We'd go to Barcelona for preseason testing. But the rest of the Formula One season, we'd call from NBC Sports headquarters in Stanford. So I was used to that. But I have to say, for the Olympics, it felt weird. It felt odd being in the studio calling those games so far away. But it was the same for pretty much everyone. You know, our leader, Mike Tirico, was there for the opening ceremonies, but then Mike came back pretty quickly because he had Super Bowl commitments. And so I think if there was just a few of us back at home base, it would have felt even more odd. But the majority of us were there. So there was some normalcy for that.
So you haven't really had the full Olympic experience since 2018 then?
Correct.
Being that Tokyo Olympics had no fans, and then Beijing, you're calling that from Connecticut.
That's right. So Pyeongchang was the last time I was at a games with you know, that felt somewhat normal, you know.
Do you expect to get back on site at the next Olympics? Is that something that you would want to do?
Yes. Yeah. We've got the track and field world championships coming up this year, which is in Budapest in Hungary. And we'll be on site for that. And I don't know definitively, but I imagine we'll be on site for Paris, which, again, I hate to use the word normal, but it will feel normal. It's like the Indy 500 this week. You know, we're seeing numbers back to pre-pandemic stages and phases. So I think Paris is going to feel like the first normal, so to speak, one in quite a few years.
So as somebody that calls a variety of different sports, what do you think about the argument that sometimes is made that race car drivers are not real athletes?
I find that preposterous. It is ridiculous. And anybody who says that, we can solve the argument in something as insignificant as a Mazda Miata at a racetrack, and after three laps, you'll be done. So happily take anybody up on that argument.
Very good.
Because they don't know what they're talking about. And it's offensive to race car drivers who are sure. some of the most elite athletes that you'll ever meet. So
yeah. But I mean, it's a narrative that does get put out there, and it gets put out there occasionally by athletes of other sports.
And they are ignorant.
Yeah.
So simple as that. I mean, you know, that would be like a race car driver saying a baseball player wasn't an athlete, or a race right. car driver saying a swimmer wasn't an athlete, or a race car driver saying a football player wasn't. It's as stupid a statement as that sounds. So even if it's an athlete saying that about a race car driver, that's an ignorant athlete, and that's sure. disrespectful to drivers.
Was there a moment in your career where you felt like you made it, and that you knew that you were going to be able to make a living out of sports casting?
It was the moment when I could stop baking carrot cakes and selling them to the local coffee shop for my gas money. And it was the moment that I got asked to be a freelance reporter on Sports Tonight in Sydney, Australia. And I thought, well, even if this is where it stays, I think I can still make a living out of this.
Do you have a really good carrot cake recipe?
I do.
Oh, wow.
It's my aunt's recipe from Australia.
How was working with David Hobbs and Steve Matchett on F1? That trio was beloved by racing fans.
Yeah, it was awesome. We're kind of, and if you throw Will Buxton, who's now gone to even more heights of notoriety thanks to Drive to Survive, you know, there was Hobbo, Steve, myself, and Will in descending age order. And I want to say we were like four brothers, but it was more like David was the father figure, the irresponsible father figure, and Steve, Will, and I were the sons. But yeah, great memories. All four of us, all four different age groups, and all four different backgrounds, and even though it was three Brits and an Aussie, but tremendous love for each other, respect, and we'd like to think that all four of us brought something different to the table, and maybe that's why it was successful. But we really did love working together.
Yeah, racing fans have a lot of respect for Hobbs' experience, obviously, but I think they especially appreciated and enjoy his willingness to speak his mind. So, like, what was that? Was that sort of brashness? Was it fun to be around in the booth?
It was. It was also like sometimes sitting on a hand grenade. We always had to remind David that where we were, and that we were on network television, and then there was a difference in terms of flexibility from where, you know, back in the Speed Channel days to then working for a network like NBC. So sometimes Steve and I had to subtly and not so subtly remind David about that, but it was a lot of fun. You know, he's kind of like, he goes beyond the crazy uncle phase. He's kind of like that, you know, the cool granddad phase.
How is it trying to fit into a broadcast where the analysts have worked together previously, and you're trying to fit into the chemistry that they've already built?
Well, the good thing about that, Brandon, was that I had a little bit of experience with them, because when our other friend Bob Varsha was the host and play-by-play at Speed Channel all those years for Formula One, Bob would have some commitments sometimes going off and doing other things that Speed required him to do. And so I was Bob's fill-in. And so Steve and David and myself and Will had worked together. You know, I'd probably do maybe anywhere between 3 to 5 or 6 Grand Prix a year or something. It'd be different each year, but I'd have to fill in for Bob, say, a handful of times each year. And that gave me that exposure with David and Steve. And then David was part of our team on the 24 Hours of Le Mans coverage. So I'd had numerous years of working with those guys. And then for quite a few years, Steve and I lived in Charlotte, North Carolina together. David would come and visit. David would stay at our house. And so, you know, I have a saying that you've got to get on off air to get on air. And all of us have stayed at each other's places and lived in each other's pockets for many years. So that was what you saw on air came very naturally.
Do you have a preference calling a race on a road track versus a road course versus a track course?
I don't have a preference. Do you mean my favorite, or you just mean like calling the differences?
The differences.
I think just the differences is what you enjoy. So what we're doing here on the big track at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is different to what we'll experience the week after on a new design street course in Detroit. And then, you know, after that, you know, we go to Road America, one of the most beautiful natural road courses. So it, rather than pinpointing what do I prefer one over the other, what I prefer is the variety. You know, I enjoy the change. Sure. and what that demands of the drivers and the engineers and the teams.
What's the longest amount of time that you've been on one broadcast for? Because you also, on these races, you don't get a halftime for a bathroom break or anything like that.
That's right. That's a good question. Well, I tell you, Brandon, what's changed our world is streaming. Mm. Because, say, for instance, on an IndyCar weekend, we would have time during the practice sessions to walk and talk. Quite often, Towns and myself, Paul Tracy, and now James, well, not Hinch, because Hinch doesn't know anything other than the streaming world. But back in the day, we would jump on a golf cart and go around to different corners and watch certain things on the track. Or we'd be in the pit lane with the engineers and the crews talking to the drivers. Now with streaming, we're talking about everything that moves. So that's really, that's changed the landscape of our regular week to week and our weekend workload. A couple of weeks ago, we had the open test here in Indy, and James Hinchcliffe and I did 8.5 hours straight on air, no breaks, because of the Peacock streaming. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
Past, you know, Fast Friday and the qualifying weekends, we were doing anywhere to 6 to 7 hours straight, no breaks. So they're long days, and you come off pretty exhausted. But I think the longest I've ever been on air is at Le Mans, at the 24 hours of Le Mans. I think I did 13 or 14 hours of the 24 by myself. Wow. Yeah.
And then you've had days where you called F1 and IndyCar on the same day. So how do you keep your voice sharp during that? How do you stay mentally sharp? Because I would imagine just one full race is pretty draining on its own.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I did that several times, and it was pretty challenging, but you just got to compartmentalize. So when F1, you know, we would have a full F1 weekend, so Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And in the downtime from that, you were either watching the practice sessions or the qualifying sessions for IndyCar and keeping abreast of that, texting, calling people. So you got one eye on this and one eye on that. And then as soon as you finish the F1 weekend, it was a mad scramble to catch the jet to either Pocono or Watkins Glen. And you kind of just try and refresh and reset and go again. But yeah, they were interesting days.
Was the Indianapolis 500 a big event in Australia when you were growing up?
I grew up in a motorcycle family. So I personally didn't grow up like listening to it on the radio or finding it on the television per se. It would be part of a program that I grew up watching called The Wide World of Sports. You'd see highlights of it, but you know, my family would stay up watching Grand Prix motorcycle racing from Europe, you know, what is now MotoGP. So in my early childhood, I can't answer that question. I'm sure it was, but it's not a childhood memory for me.
How is it there now? Is it a big event now?
Yeah, it's on a streaming service in Australia, and certainly more people pay attention to it because of the likes of, say, Will Power, Scott Dixon, now in recent years, Scott McLaughlin. It's not like there haven't been Aussies or Kiwis involved, but certainly with the prolific success of Dixon and Power, that has helped things. And now, you know, with Scott McLaughlin coming straight from supercars to IndyCar a couple of years ago, really heightened everybody's interest down there because they wanted to see if he was able to successfully make that switch from supercars to IndyCar, which he has.
What makes this race so special in your mind? I heard Al Michaels on the Pat McAfee show last week, and he said the start of the Indy 500 is as exhilarating as anything in sports. What makes the Indy 500 different from other races?
Well, it makes it not only different from other races, but from but for other sporting events too, Brandon, because when you go to a Super Bowl, there might be 65,000 or 70,000 people there or whatever it might be. And the next year, the Super Bowl's in a different location, a different venue. Same for the Olympics. You know, it's a monstrosity. But it's different events at different times over the 2.5 weeks. You have the Football World Cup, you know, again, played over the course of a month, et cetera, but different locations and then culminates in the one final. But there's not an event on the planet where you have 330,000 people in the one place at the one time. And the energy that you feel from that group, the largest single day sporting crowd in the world, is like nothing else that you've ever experienced. So for people who have never been to the Indianapolis 500, that my words don't mean anything. Anybody's words don't mean anything until you've experienced it for yourself. And Al's correct. There is nothing more exhilarating than when you're going to see 33 cars do 230 miles an hour. And when they come back, they come up the main straight, three abreast on lap one. For me, when they pack up down the back straight on the last parade lap and they go through turn three and they're coming to the short chute, you see the masses. They all stand and you can hear that, you know, they start cheering, they start whistling. They know something massive's about to happen. And that gives you goosebumps. There's no feeling like when you know, it's coming to the start of the race. And then for anybody who's been trackside to see an IndyCar, just a single IndyCar at 230 miles an hour go through a turn is ridiculous. It just sends this jolt through your body. And then when you get to see 33 of them on track, all doing that, trying to do the best they can while fighting off 32 others, I mean, it's madness, but it is beautiful madness.
You mentioned that you raced motorcycles when you were younger, just kind of growing up. I would imagine if you've raced motorcycles before, that you got to be somewhat of a thrill seeker. What is the rush like? How does it compare being on the call for the Indy 500 with 300,000 people watching in attendance, and then knowing that there's millions of people watching at home as well?
It's a huge rush. It's a huge rush because, you know, for the simple fact that there is nothing else like it in the world. And, yeah, you know that you're going to have this long form story over several hours because it's a 500 mile race, but then you've got to hit these key points. And it's the fact that you're there in this cathedral that will hold 330,000 people.
Right.
It gives you the juice. It gives you the energy, you know, and it's so raw. It's an exhilarating feeling, you know, knowing they come down that chute and it's just, you hear, you know, we're up on the ninth floor of the pagoda and it feels like we're in the middle of the fan base. That's the noise and the volume and just the intensity and the weight of that experience. So that really is broadcasters. That drives us.
Yeah.
Like we feel, you know, at track and field meets, we sit in amongst the fans in the stands. Well, it feels like that for us at Indy, that you're right in there amongst them. And that drives us, even though we're somewhat separated on television, it drives us and it influences our call.
How was the 2021 Indy 500? It was one of the first big events with fans back in attendance after the start of COVID. And then Elio Castroneves wins his fourth 500 that year. I went back and I listened to that call recently, and I thought you did an awesome job of capturing the excitement without stepping on the historic moment as well.
We always get reminded by our producers and our bosses to, you know, in TV terms, it's called laying out, which means stop talking.
Yeah.
And listen to the actual natural environment and the natural sound that is occurring. And when Elio won and that beautiful fence climb and then everything else that transpired after that, including Mario Andretti coming out and giving him a hug and a kiss on the head, it was like he was, you know, anointed from that point on. It was beautiful. But before Elio won, you know, come back to the beginning of the race before the green flag flew, you know, there were fans back in the stands, albeit to a limited number.
Right.
But when they're coming to the green, you know, it's incumbent upon me to try and say something half sensible and intelligent, that tries to give the viewers, wherever they're watching around the world, some semblance of relevance and something appropriate for the time. And it just, I don't plan those words. I like them to come to me in the moment. And just seeing the people back in the stands that came to me in the moment, I remember saying, the soul is back at the Speedway, meaning the fans, because the juxtaposition was the year before, where for the first time in the history of the race, we had nobody there, no fans allowed in the stands. And it was the most empty feeling, empty and eerie feeling. So then to fast forward to 21, it really did feel like the soul was back at the Speedway, and the race, we've experienced it. We know the race isn't the same when the fans aren't there. So that was a huge moment, you know, to come back to the Speedway with the people there.
Is that, would you consider that your most memorable call, that combination of having 150,000 people back at the Speedway paired with being part of history for Elio's first fourth win?
Yeah, I've never been asked that before. Yeah, I'd go with you and say yeah. Yeah, just because of the significance of it. It was the largest gathering post-pandemic anywhere in the world. And it was pretty amazing. And then the cherry on top was Elio winning a fourth and joining right. that club. And then I'm pretty sure it was the next day or it was in the coming days or weeks after that, there was a photo taken of the four. So AJ Foyt, Alan Cecinha, Rick Mears and Elio Castroneves. And within a matter of months, Al Senior was gone. And so it was just that piece of history and that those four members of the four-time club, they all happened to be there to see Elio win, which made it even more significant.
Sure.
And beautiful. I'd go with that. That was the most special for sure.
How many monitors do you have in front of you when calling the Indy 500?
Believe it or not, not that many. We have one central one, which is our program, which is exactly what you're watching at home. Because with a little bit of wriggle room here or there, we have to be talking about what you're watching. Otherwise, right. as a viewer, as a consumer, you would get frustrated that, like, well, what are they talking about? I can't see it, you know?
Yeah.
We have some statistical feeds, some timing and scoring feeds. Townsend Bell and James Hinchcliffe have, you know, when you see on football or whatever, you see the lines, the squiggles and the wiggles and the circles and everything. Right. That's called a telestrator. They have access to the telestrator now. Which is a new one now, which is equipped with emojis and stuff. So now they're like children. They've got a new toy to play with. And then we have an ISO monitor, which our production truck is able to play us something without it going on air, in case either of the analysts or myself, we want to look at it and say, yeah, go with that. And meanwhile, we're talking behind the scenes so that you're not hearing. So if I'm on talkback talking to the producer or director, James or Townsend might be talking, or one of our pit reporters are talking. And so long answer short is we don't have this wall of monitors
right.
like they do in the production truck. It's pretty much what you're watching at home with a little bit of enhancement on the side.
So you're basically just kind of calling off what you see wherever the camera is following, because it's got to be a little bit hard. Like in most sports, the play-by-play announcer can see the entire playing field or their calling the action by following the ball or the puck. Uh-huh. In motorsports, you can't always see the entire track and you can't call all of the action that's going on. So like, how are you deciding where to focus?
Well, it's fully focused on the feed. It's fully focused on exactly what you're watching at home. Yeah. But if something has grabbed any of our attention, we're up on the ninth floor of the pagoda. And we can see pretty much, if we look this direction, we can see them coming out of turn three down the short chute, turn four. We can see them come all the way up the front stretch past us because we're right above the yard of bricks, and we can see them tails away going into turn one. So if something isn't on the screen that we wanted to see, maybe even though we can see the time gap, it might be 1 second between you and me.
Right.
By us simply standing up and having a look, there might be something else there that James or Townsend or myself might see that grabs our attention that we can then embellish and help enhance the story by what we've seen, or maybe also tell the production truck that that's what we've seen as well, that they could get a camera to help the coverage. So it's all of the above. It's a little bit of everything.
What do you think of the docuseries 100 Days to Indy? Has that impacted the sport and its popularity at all?
I couldn't give an answer on a measurable, influence that it's had, but simply, extra eyeballs and delivering a different flavor, so to speak, like showing, peeling back the layers and showing the drivers as humans. That's always the challenge in motorsport. It's getting inside the helmet. Like, who are these people? We know they're brave. We know they're fast. We know they're risk takers, but what kind of people are they? Where did Pato Award come from, and what's his upbringing like, and what drives Joseph Newgarden to be this, NFL-esque type, physical, massive muscle that he loves to, he takes his health and fitness so seriously, but he's a family man, a lot of the guys in the field are family people, and, just peeling back those layers. So I don't know yet if it's made a measurable difference on the sport, but I think it's just nice to have another avenue of information and entertainment, and showing that these guys who are fighter pilots on the ground are actually real people.
What about legalized sports gambling? Has that impacted IndyCar, and has that had any influence on the broadcast at all?
No influence on the broadcast. Not at all. Not that I could see. I hear people occasionally talking about it, but it's not. It's I wouldn't put it in comparison to, say, football or baseball,
sure,
or NBA. I don't. Just me, and I might be out of the loop. I don't think so, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about sports gambling when it comes to IndyCar.
So, what should a casual fan or somebody who's watching their first IndyCar race this weekend, what should they be looking for?
Just look for the incredible feat that these drivers achieve and execute every single lap, and hopefully for 200 laps. Just to do one lap of what they're doing is extraordinary, and they do it for 200 laps. So look for speed, look for excitement, look for who is the smartest strategically and who's the bravest with their moves, who's the smartest at controlling their temperament. Look for all of the above, and hopefully as a first-time viewer, they're going to be captivated with what they see. But it's speed, it's danger, it's bravery. I mean, these guys are badasses.
Which winner would make for the best story? Is it Elio potentially winning his fifth?
I think there's a myriad of stories that could unfold. If Elio wins his fifth, it's going to be incredible. Scott Dixon has been so close so many times. Does Takuma Sato come in on a one-off pretty much, even though he's doing the other oval races this year, and win his third? It's been a source of frustration for Joseph Newgarden. As a two-time champion, this carrot keeps dangling here, and he hasn't been able to bite it yet. There's lots of stories. Some of these young guys, what about the young superstars like Colton Herders and Pato O'Ward and Felix Rosenquist and guys like that? Are they going to do something spectacular? So it's a difficult question with a difficult answer, because I'm not sure. I mean, Elio would be the biggest headline, winning five, of course, but there's so many other worthwhile winners and worthwhile stories.
And then what about even just now the narrative surrounding Graham Rahal, who was bumped from the race, but we're recording this on Tuesday, and he was just announced that he was going to be back in the race as a replacement driver.
Well, I think it's extraordinary, isn't it? It's extraordinary. And with Indy, as he well knows now, anything can happen. Anything can happen. And if you look at where Stefan was, like, Stefan Wilson qualified that car in 24th position. He'd had a good month of May. Graham knows the capability of the car because it was quicker than him. And so, he's been given a second chance. And I think he'll capitalize on that. That would be a remarkable story. And in fact, if any of his Rahal, Letterman, Lanigan teammates turn around their month of May, and that's the one-off, Catherine Legg, the only woman in the field, Christian Lundgaard or Jack Harvey, who ultimately bumped him out on Sunday, if they turn their month of May around, that would be an incredible story as well.
So from teaching physical education to being NBC's lead broadcaster for IndyCar and one of the more recognizable voices at the Olympics, what goals at this point in your career do you still have? Are there sports or specific events that you'd still like to try calling that you haven't yet, or anything that you haven't done that you want to?
Well, it's on the wrong network at the moment, but I'd feel pretty good if I got a chance to call the Daytona 500 one day. That'd be pretty neat. I think as far as global big ticket events around the world in motorsport, I've pretty much done them. Le Mans, Rolex 24 at Daytona, you know, Formula One, Monaco Grand Prix, Indy 500, Dakar Rally, you know, MotoGP Grand Prix, you know, a lot of, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to do a lot of cool events around the world, but doing Daytona would be neat. And I have done some NASCAR work for NBC over the years, right, called both Cup and Xfinity. So, but that, you know, that's, who knows, but for now, just keep trying to be, even though I've been at this for 25, 26 years, just keep trying to be better. You know, just everybody can be better in everything they do. We can all keep getting better every day, every year, every broadcast. And so keep having fun. Anybody who knows me knows that I like to have fun. And so keep having fun, keep delivering, not only for NBC, but keep delivering for the viewers. You know, make it interesting, make it enjoyable. I'm a consumer too, right? I go home to my wife and two sons, and we enjoy watching television. We enjoy watching live sport. And I know what I want out of the broadcasters that I enjoy watching. So I try to be that for everybody who enjoys watching the sports that I work on.
Lee, you are awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the Awful Announcing Podcast. Enjoy the weekend and have a great call.
Well, I follow you guys. I follow the site, the cast, everything. So thanks for having me on. I'm a fan of you guys too. So thank you.
Awesome. Very much appreciate that. That is Lee Diffie. I'm Brandon Contis. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. As always, thanks for listening and be good.
Thanks for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast. For the latest news spanning the sports media landscape and more, check out awfulannouncing.com and follow us at awfulannouncing.com.